Hello and welcome to the TT Podcast, the podcast where we talk to one person from the world of the TT to discuss their lives, their journeys and their ambitions with the greatest motorsporting event in the world. And we, Steve, are now officially the greatest motorsporting podcast in the world. We are award winners.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Is that your first ever win?
Unfortunately, it is, yeah. Yeah, let's not dwell on that. Steve, question for you. How does it rank amongst your TT wins?
Well, in all fairness, I've got some lovely, shiny trophies from winning various races, and especially the best one, the senior. So where's my trophy, fellas?
Yeah, we didn't even get a trophy, did we? All three of the producers sat on their phones, texting away. In fact, you probably heard one of them vibrate then. Unbelievable. How on earth did we win it? Do you know why we won it? Because of people out there that voted for us. So on behalf of me, Steve, the producers, and Lee, I've already mentioned it, but a huge thank you to everybody that voted, because without you, we'd no one would be listening to us, would they?
Yeah, thanks very much from us.
Appreciate it. Right, let's get on with today's episode of the podcast. A big, strapping giant of a man. If you were going to build a TT racer, you'd build him like Sean Anderson, wouldn't you? He's primed and prepped for a TT racer.
He's a big unit, a busy boy, races the TT, the Manx, and races well.
Yeah, but away from motorcycling, racing in general, he does a lot behind the scenes for a lot of companies, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's got a very interesting workload away from racing. I'm looking forward to asking a lot of questions about that, not just his racing career.
What are you going to try and find out from him?
Just various things, really.
Go on,
you know,
then.
He's married to a racer as well.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I never knew this.
Yep. You see, I do homework.
Do what?
Homework.
Never heard of it. So what does she race in?
She races the Manx.
Oh, I never knew that. I should really look into people that we have on the... It's Sean Anderson. It's not Sean Anderson's missus's podcast. It's Sean.
She'll be listening.
I hope she is.
Mm-mm.
Right,
you're
anyway.
You're in trouble.
No, I'm not. Sean can tell us all about her career when he gets here.
I'll do.
All right, let's get on with this episode of the podcast, Stephen. Head over here.
All right, sweetheart.
Sean Anderson, 39 years old, 43 TT starts, 27 TT finishes, a hit rate of 53%-ish. Fastest lap of 130.357 miles an hour. So he's also hit the 130 club. But less of that, we'll talk about all that later on. Sean, what I want to know is, do you listen to the TT podcast?
You have to understand, right, I'm a complete TT fanatic. There isn't a YouTube clip for 3 seconds of somebody going flat out through the bottom of a gara that I don't watch. Oh, there's a new podcast this week. Oh, there's Between the Hedges, there's a such and such, there's a documentary in German about such, like Trummer or somebody like that there. Right, I watch that with subtitles. There isn't anything that goes on
Mega.
That I don't try to keep my hand in.
I'm the same.
Terms of TT, I'm like completely obsessed. History of the TT, course knowledge, notes, this, that, and the other. So, like,
has that been something you've always done? Have you always been a TT fanatic from the word go? Or
actually, so as a like, I was brought up around bikes all my life, but the TT was like something that my dad helped out racers at the TT, a racer from Tandragee direction, and it was something that my dad went off to the TT. And when I was brought once as a child when I was about 10 or 11, just before you finished primary school. And in comparison to the excitement of group racing in Ireland, like road racing in a group.
Yeah.
When you're 10 and you see someone go, boom, he'd be back in 15 minutes, 20 minutes. And the next guy goes, boom. It was not exciting.
Yeah.
But when you, as I grew older and grew into it and understood it as a spectacle, then it only came to consume me more and more. And then, I, as I say, spectator once, and the next time I was there was to race.
And how old were you then?
Oh, I was an old boy. I would come to this way too late. I was 26 when I first did the Manx in 2010.
Bloody hell. So in between going and watch it as a TT fan and then racing it as a TT competitor or a Manx competitor, what's happened in all that time?
There's quite a bit, like, obviously, in that time frame, but in general, like...
Has it been bikes all the way through, though?
It was always bikes, but I never raced. I wasn't a child prodigy type thing. My father's, like, complete, also, motorcycle enthusiast, loves road racing, TT and all the rest.
Did he race?
No. I'm a Gen 1 racer. Yeah. So, So always had bikes around me, ride bikes for fun. I think there was an importance on an element of like push, or not to push, like be a competition dad of like screaming at kids and all. So it was always like bikes were fun. Go to practice days on motocross trials, rode a lot of trials, this, that and the other. But, and then I was just a bloody idiot on the road. I like me and my wife joke, I still have no idea how I made that sort of like from 16 till I started racing when I was 24. that gap, I mean, the bones, the scars are all there to prove it, but I, you know, touch wood one way or another, like I actually made it there. And then because I had been brought up with somebody who had mechanic, I was like, well, I'll be a mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope friends who started racing, and maybe they won't. On a Sunday morning, on a sprightly run to wherever, they might not have been as quick, but they started to get top tens in racing, and I was like, I think I might have to give this racing malarkey a go.
That was it?
And that was at age 24, so I'd finished university and got my degree in engineering and this, that, and the other, in motorcycle engineering and design, and I said, I'm going to do 1 year. Just 1 year, probably be no good, but I'll have experience of saying I raced at some time. And then... But as soon as I raced, like I already knew because I was a road rider, I was like, going to somewhere that's flat, especially in Ireland, like Kirkaston, Bishop's Court, everything's ex airfield is flat and boring as sin. Whereas like you on a Monday morning on the way to work, you were tearing over blind crests and jumps and this, that and the other. So it was like, well, I think I'll have to just do some road racing. And then... The Everest of road racing is the TT.
Yeah.
For a real amateur, it's a Manx Grand Prix, and with aspirations of the TT after that. And it was always like, well, we'll go there once and try and see what it's like and whether I like it and whether I don't and all the rest. And yeah, just snowballed from there on.
Were you any good, trials rider?
I'd like to tell you I was.
Modern or pre-65?
Sorry?
Modern bikes.
So, I still have a gas in the garage. So, both me and my wife both have trials bikes. So, in terms of like...
Who's the best?
I'll keep the peace that we're both aspiring trials riders.
So, go back to your first race then. Obviously, you thought you were a bit of a doer on the road, on the commute to work.
Yeah.
But then... You know, it's a completely different kettle of fish when you get onto a start line with 20, 30 other people. Where was your first race? How did it go?
Oh, so, I mean, it's quite funny. So there used to be like a closed-to-club race at the very start of the year. It was a Paddy's Day weekend, so middle of March, Ireland, obviously tropical weather. And it was primarily for, there was a specific like amateur clubman's, like rookie 600 style in the ACU sort of format. And... instantly turned up, pish wet day, crashed in first qualifying, like touched the white line, down I went, qualified wherever. And the first race was like working my way through, finished 12th, and second race finished 10th. And I come away like, oh, you know, this race in Malarkey, it's not too bad, I think.
What was this on?
Like 2003 R6, and this was 2008, right. So she was a wee bit long in the tooth. And I thought, I'm the man, obviously, like top 10 first week, race weekend, brilliant and all that. The following weekend, Easter fell early, and Easter's the real start of the season in Ireland. So like Easter Saturday, back to Bishop's Court, but you're with national men. And this was 2008, so you had sort of peak Cameron Donald and Bruce Anstey on relentless Tass Suzukis. And I can remember the first chicane up the back at Bishop's Court. Anybody who knows Bishop's Court knows the sort of first flip-flop chicane. And I was sort of like teeterly tipping in, and Cameron Donald just came under me and went boom, boom, from right left. And he was exiting, and I was still entering the corner, and I came away from that, like, from going from, like, top 10, this racing's definitely, it's just coming so easy to being like, I don't know. Is what I'm doing classified as still riding a motorcycle at that stage? So I was like, I really went from like 2 weekends before on a high of all highs to like just being like, these people, they're not on a, like, they don't work on the same level as
physics
other people.
Don't apply to them.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God. But you kept at it. You committed to it then.
Yeah. I mean, we messed around that first season, 600s, and then I got a fluke chance to ride 1,000, which happened to be like a cousin of mine's that was, it's in the back of the lorry. If you want to pay for the extra entry, you can have a run on my 1,000. And I like jumped up. I'm a big lad now, but I was a bit bigger even then. And like just took to 1,000cc, like duck to water. And it was like, okay, right, let's get rid of this R6 and get a big bike for next year. And then I did another year in short circuits and thousands, lifted the amateur championship in Ireland, the Clubman's Championship, and was like, right, what do we do now? Either you can go to like national 1,000cc, but you had a lot of like top guys like Michael Pearson, Kirk Jemison at that time in Ireland. The Irwin, like Glenn, was coming through in 600. He obviously moved on to much bigger and better things and all the rest. And we were like, and I was like, well, I really fancy a run at the Rhodes. And 2010, I started doing the Rhodes, and we did the Manx in 2010, and that was the love affair was written with Le Mans from that point onwards.
Yeah. How do you take to like a duck to water on a 1,000cc bike? Because I hate to bring my motorcycling expertise up, but I remember the first time I jumped on a 1,000, and I my brain and body could not tolerate what was going on. And that was at Portimao, big wide open circuit, so it's pretty slow. How do you get on it and go, yeah, this is for me, this?
I think it all depends when you're exposed to that sort of scenario, because like I was 25 by that, or 24, 25 at that stage, and it was and a complete speed addict. So it was like everything had to be ridden as fast as it possibly could be ridden. So it was like, here's a bike that you've, like, I only ever had 600s on the road running. So here's a bike, but turned up to 11. And it was just like, wow. It's like giving an addict, here's a big bag of whatever you're addicted to, and have a load more of it. Well, what's not to love about it? So
true. Yeah, but it's not just turned up to 11. It's turned up to 11 and then added a bit more to it. I don't think people realize how fast these bikes are. And the way you guys ride them and make them look like they're so easy to ride, I think it doesn't really do it justice, just how fast those things are, does it?
You told me you was really good.
I am pretty good. I'm pretty good.
We'll find out at Hereth.
I'm only on a, I've got a little Triumph, 675. But I'll put a few people to bed. Don't you worry about that.
And what about on the track?
Hey, this is family friendly, this.
Oh, okay.
Oh, right. So, Sean, normally we start the podcast. As an avid fan of the podcast, you'll even know what first question we have. But seeing as we kind of started chatting, we let it roll. But let me rewind it back a little bit. The tap on the shoulder. Now, not to diminish your talent, because you're way faster than I'll ever be. But by the time you get the tap on the shoulder, we've had maybe 15 to 20 riders going off. So a lot of them have had the tap on the shoulder before you've even probably put your helmet on. So let's talk about the tap on the shoulder, but what is it like being a rider slightly further down the grid? And I'm not belittling that, but you get to see a lot of them go before you've even probably prepped and you're ready to go. So how does that like 5 or 10 minutes feel as the riders are leaving and you're getting ready? Then once you are ready, what's going through your head at that point?
I mean, you get the same bing bongs that everybody gets. Gary comes over, says those words, like, and then you really sort of think, whoa, this is happening. The butterflies really start to kick off at that stage. You head up onto the road. And like you say, you'll hear the first guy, like the RPM rise, and then they fire off into the distance. For me at this stage now, being in the seated riders and all the rest, you're sort of that 2-3 minutes away. And you feel the intensity, but you also have an ability to like understand what's going on. Like, you know, right, the race is on. Basically, the way I look at it is, you know, the hair has left and it's the Greyhounds are at the gate, so whoever, whether it's one or whether it's 15 or 20 guys in front of you, those guys are being let out and you're in your cage waiting to chase that round the track. And so, I mean, you feel that intensity, like there's nowhere like the Isle of Man that you feel intensity like the start of the build-up of a TT race. I'm not a soldier, but I could only imagine that it's something similar. Maybe I romanticize about it, like going off to war, because no one wants to be there trying to G up because they know that you know your job to do, but they all want to have a pat on the bum or just to say a good luck and all this, and just in case something bad or untoward happens.
Yeah.
But everybody hopes that you're going to come home a hero, and that may not happen. And so you have that like strange stares, quick meet of the eyes with different people and all the rest. I like to just have like a few people around me, quiet word, joke, talk last minute strategies. Then the helmet goes on. Don't really talk to anybody after that. And you start rolling up and you can feel it just building, building, building.
Yeah.
And then you get to that no man's land. And then you have this tranquil, peaceful area. And you're still, you know, maybe 30, 40 seconds before you go. And you maybe take a look around. You see the ones that you care most about and all the rest. And then focus in on the job. Rolling up to the guy, I have to say, it's not the same. I've never felt the tap on the shoulder ever once. So, I mean, I roll up, I have the same sort of procedure. I try to go through these sorts of motions that it's well practiced. And at this stage, I'm really well practiced at it. And you bring the RPMs up, you find the biting point of the clutch. So the bike sort of lurches forward, that sort of 2-3 inches. You'll feel the guy squeeze you on the shoulder. But I'm that focused on the main timekeeper with the flag.
Yeah.
If he happened to sneeze, that guy's getting dragged down Glencrutchy Road with me, because like he might try to hold you back, but I'm that focused on the flag. I have to say, it's not to diminish that guy's job, but I have never felt the tap on the shoulder, because you're that ultra focused on the flag that whatever he was doing, it wouldn't really matter, because if that flag moved a millimeter, the clutch is going in a way and the chase has started.
So here's a question that I don't think I've really ever asked anyone. When you've got one guy that goes up the road, and obviously there's a 10-second gap. Sometimes if there's a guy missing, there'll be a 20-second gap. In that 10 seconds, the moment he lifts that flag in that 10-second start, are you counting that in your head? Have you got like a roll-up procedure? Because some people roll up really slow in the hope to get there in the last couple of seconds. Some kind of roll straight up and sit there with a clutch in, with the revs rising. Like, what is it
so
for you?
It's the longest 20 seconds in the world. Yeah. So like last year I was away at number 18 and poor old Gaz Johnson was missing at 17. So I had this and I think Sweeney was meant to be 17 in the Supersport, and he was missing. So every race I started, I pretty much had this endless gap, and it feels forever when someone's not there. And to be fair to the guy, the tap on the shoulder guy, he gives you a T signal to tell you that you're down to 10 seconds. And only then do I really like switch into the mode. I arrive, I would say, early, promptly, because you get up to you want to hit your marks. You want to make sure that everything's right. If you have a start procedure on the bike, or if launch control or anything along those sorts of lines that wants to be, that you haven't put yourself under any additional pressure because you're not being rushed over the whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
You see him 10, even that 10 still seems forever because the road's empty. The silence has sort of dropped and all the rest. So it feels very different when there's no one there in comparison to when there is somebody there.
Yeah.
I mean, even psychologically, depending on where you get off the line, when it's sort of even Stevens, when you turn out a quarter bridge, you'll just see the glimpse of somebody tipping into Braddon. And if you see them for more than a glimpse, you think, the chase is really on here.
Yeah.
I've already made time and I'm only going to keep making time. And if you get down there and somebody's been away 10 seconds and they're not there, your heart's a wee bit broken at that stage.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it might use that as fuel to sort of G yourself up to be like, right, you've already made some sort of error, you've lost time, you need to get in your flow and get going here.
Yeah, I suppose with that 20-second gap, where are you 20 seconds after the... Are you going up Agos Leap already, or...
I would say they're probably...
They're out of sight, aren't they?
Yeah, they're
by the
Garth heading down towards the hump before Quarter Bridge.
Yeah.
You know, it's a long old gap, especially if you know, like, you tend... the closer you get to the front, the more you focus in and around who's going to be around you, what their pace was in practice and all. If you know that they were very similarly placed to you, you're thinking 20 seconds could be a long time. If you know that someone's maybe had a bad practice week or anything like that, you'll be like, well, I hope to see them by Kirkmichael or something in 20 seconds. You might have taken 20 seconds. The 10-second gap's a much easier chase. But if you know like somebody's 20 seconds in front of you and they're on similar pace, you might see them going up the mountain mile, and that'll be the first time, even if you're on a good pace yourself, unless you've made an exceptional start and they've made a mistake somewhere, a run on, or really cost themselves big.
Would you rather not see anybody at all race, or do you enjoy catching them because it gives you that extra motivation just to move up a little bit and increase your pace?
I think there's always a certain aspect of, I think, my own ability, I work best on the chase. Like, mm-hmm. you have that fuel and that fire. And it's not real racing as in wheel to wheel, because if you've made the time, you've already... You sort of feel like they should give it up whenever you arrive. They never do.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's one of those sorts of things where if you can see a guy and then you see another guy, because the guy that you've caught first is already catching the guy in front,
yep.
there's just always that hare to chase, like I say. And when it's an open, empty road, it can be a wee bit demoralizing. I have had the privilege of going off at number one at the Manx Grand Prix, and it was quite a different sort of atmosphere in terms of being that, you know, McGuinness and all that talk about the bird scare. So
yeah.
that's quite a difficult, lonely race. But there's joy in that loneliness, because if you haven't seen anybody and nobody's caught you, then you know you're on good pace. But it's a very different approach.
You're a CD rider, and if they said to you all of a sudden you're going off number one, how would that make you feel? Well, you've pretty much answered it. I know obviously the TT is a little bit different pace-wise, but it's still, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I was number one in my newcomers race, so it was like pressure unbelievable. Like everything was ramped up to like way over to exaggerate everything, because it was the first time you ever rolled up to a start. The first tap on the shoulder ever in your career, and you were the number one guy going away. So that was definitely a very different mentality in comparison to if I was given an opportunity to start number one now, knowing what you know and how to not like get ahead of yourself, come out of the box all G'd up, full of adrenaline, and fighting the bike for the first 3 miles, whereas you're trying to like instantly relax yourself in, find your pace, find your rhythm, and then like the time will come and your pace will be there, and then you have confidence and, well, I'm doing all I can do, and if somebody catches me, somebody catches me, but there's not a lot else you can do about that. But if you find your rhythm very early and you're still having a nice lonely race, if you're away at number one, I'm sure there's very few things that are as rewarding, knowing that that road's open for you. There's going to be no distractions, no holdups.
You said to you said earlier that you like a few people around you at the start before you set off and so on, and a few nice words, and obviously your loved one. But you know, when you're riding for a team, which you do, do you feel added pressure from them, or do you try and shut that out?
I don't think so. I mean, every rider, I think, as you well know, is there. Like, no one is going to give you a G up, or you feel like you have to impress per se, that they're going to be like, wow, we really. If you don't have that motivation inside yourself, and you're needing somebody else to put pressure on you from a team structure or anything like that, you're probably not maybe cut out for the whole game. I mean, the few opportunities that I've had for the teams that I've ridden, there's definitely been, I wouldn't say an expectation, but in terms of like, this is definitely a good opportunity here and you would be foolish to waste it. So there comes an added amount, but that comes more from yourself than anything. I've never had any ill effects from the people around me in terms of like, well, he's here or the sponsor's flown in, and so I'm going to have to try and like find another 2/10 on the run out to Ballacrean or this, that, and the other. That has never been a motivator for me, but I could understand like the further you climb those numbers, the bigger the money that's involved, the more people that there is an expectation, and there is that pressure that comes with it, and with an expectation of, well, we've given you these bikes and you got the best of this and the best of that and all the rest. So I could understand why it would play into the mind some ways.
Did it play into yours, Steve?
No, you know, mine was a short time, obviously, at the TT. I only did 3 TTs, but, you know, I think realistically I was more result-orientated than financial. But as you just said, you put yourself under a massive amount of pressure anyway. You know, I've won the other road races, and this was the king of the castle. And in all fairness, I didn't go there to win. I did, of course, but I mean, I went there to try and get on the podium if possible after my first year. But now it's difficult. And because, you know, we'll talk about more your lifestyle and what you do away from racing later, but, you know, you've got some big jobs and you're a very clever fella in the industry. But does that kind of clash with working with a team? Do you want it your way rather than theirs?
I would hope. I mean, the teams might tell you differently, obviously. But I try to come with, because my job is motorcycles outside of racing, I try to keep a professional approach, you know, because solving problems, overcoming, making sure that progress is done in projects and all the rest, that's my bread and butter. That's what pays my bills at the end of the day. So trying to keep that sort of mindset and mantra and all the rest. And, you know, racing is like just the pressure turned up to an unassailable amount, because you don't have a year. It's not a 3-year project we're working on. It has to happen inside these 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And if it's not going to happen, why is it not going to happen? And there's additional stress and strain that has to be put on people, whether it's the rider, whether it's mechanics, because things are happening, failures occur, mechanical breakdowns, whether it's the performance level of the bike and all the rest. And you hope to have as much as you can all those sorts of things prepared for and like minimized, that any errors and all the rest, that they don't come out. But the Isle of Man is a very special place in terms of that. Like, I've seen people fall out who are like the best of friends, you know. And it's even in daft things, like 2019 jumps out at me. We had a very bad week of weather, and there was number of like scrabbles in the paddock. Thankfully, I try to keep out of the paddock. I try, if it's going to be rained off or there's some delays and all that, everybody needs that sort of like space from each other. Mm-hmm. But you know, you're on top of each other for 2 weeks, so you think of people's nerves start to fray, because it's just this pressure cooker for 2 weeks, and everybody wants the best to happen and everybody's best intentions. Yeah, I think from my side, I try to hopefully arrive with a relatively relaxed professional aid. But you know, when things aren't going wrong or aren't going right, should I say, then you have to really press in. And a lot of the time that comes more from self-reflection, because like at the end of the day, the person who can make the biggest difference is usually the rider.
Mm-hmm.
Your wife races as well.
Yep.
You know, and she's not a bad hand.
Yep.
You just spoke then about obviously keeping cool and keeping calm. And I've read in an interview, she says you're very methodical, think things through, for her racing and yours as well. Tandra Gee, when she passed you off a start line, how methodical were you in catching and trying to keep up or get past her?
You've really done your research. It has to be said, it was there was a number of sad circumstances around that, in so much as a friend had asked me to ride a 125, and anybody who's ever met me would know that maybe I would not naturally look as a 125 rider. And so first time ever racing a two-stroke.
I think, to be honest, just jumping in there, the first look, you'd think you worked on a door in Belfast somewhere.
Thanks, I guess.
There's a compliment in there somewhere.
Yeah. And getting a small bike, particularly like Grand Prix 125, off the line, there's a knack to it. And maybe her 6 or 7 years experience at that stage might have come into it. But I have to say, going up the hill thinking I've really blown this, We got to a set of bends, and I did hesitate I don't think I would have on if it had been anybody else, but I waited patiently to pass in a timely, safe space, as opposed to, I think if it had been somebody else, they might have got lifted a wee bit harder, a wee bit earlier. So
That was the last lap, I don't believe you. You would not have left it.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. But the same applies for her. I mean, we joke because she raced against her father on 125s and pushed him hard at the last corner of Kells, which is a real square T-junction-y type corner. So she has every bit of, you know, the knife between the teeth as any other competitor out there. So and that's the game. At the end of the day, everybody's friends off track, as you well know. But when the visor comes down, whether it's marriage or friendship in the bar, it doesn't really count for a whole lot on track.
So turn that around from what you said on the start line, where you, you know, on Glencrutchery Road, where you like a few people around you, and of course the wife. How does it feel for you when she's setting off?
It's so tough. It is really like, until you've done it, and I had helped guys out and all the rest, but when you have a real, like, it's not that you wish any ill on anybody or anything like that, but when you have a connection, like your wife or somebody that's a brother or something, or a son in many father cases or anything like that, there is so, you feel that heavy atmosphere going up there. You feel the weight of those decisions that you've made in the pre-start area. You feel the weight of like making sure that the brake calipers are torqued and the back wheels in and the tire pressures are done and all the rest. Everything that goes on it. And seeing them off, you know, there's so much joy comes from it because they're doing what they love. Mm. But that time spent on that pit wall, I mean, that's a long, long time to be waiting and thinking, and especially if you have an insider knowledge, they should be here there by now. They should be there by now,
yeah,
and all the rest. And you're very remote, you know. The guys in the pit lane, they're not allowed any electronic devices. So there's people yelling information across. It's quite a busy time anyway. But like when you're in that pit box waiting, and you have to wait out every lap just in case they come in with a technical issue, you know. So you can't be diving back across to find out what speed they did at Solby. Have they been through Ramsey? Have they got to the mountain box? Where are they on the list? It's a case of you're in there and you're sort of isolated. You get maybe these odd signals from somebody across the wall to say she's been through, or you might hear on the radio mention something like that there, but it is the longest time with like the heaviest thoughts, because you're alone in there with your thoughts.
I suppose it's one of those things where you know the enjoyment that they're getting out of it, so you can never say please don't do it.
Definitely not. I wouldn't even consider it crossing my mind in terms of like what she wants to do and all the rest. Like, and the same goes the opposite way. And the thought of like helping somebody through and like sort of, I wouldn't say taking the reins, but we talk about like dad and lad racing.
Mm-hmm.
She was also heavily involved. Like, her father was a racer, and she's a Gen 2 racer, as I call her, because I have to do it all my own way because I like to pat myself on the back. And she had like, not opportunity, but like at least somebody with a knowledge to come through on it from a racing point of view. And taking that over from Steve's side, the responsibility as he sort of went into retirement,
yeah,
of looking after the safety and how heavy that sits on you and all the rest. But at the same time, we met through racing. So for anybody to come and sort of say, well, do you think you should maybe think about stepping back from it and this, that and the other, it never even would cross either of our minds. We both enjoy motorcycles in racing and motorcycles outside of racing trials, and we were at Tong for the British Enduro there to watch Dean go round and all those sorts of things. Like, our whole house is a motorcycling sort of family and fraternity in that way.
So apart from the fact you've just said it was much easier for her,
it's always easier
in the racing. So pre-season or during the season, when it's down to budget time and spending, who gets priority?
On me.
No messing.
No.
Is that agreed?
She might see that differently, but she would also tell you the number of holidays that haven't occurred because of my budget. So she can't disagree with the facts of that. And there is no grumbling from her, because she also understands that's a critical topic. And the same goes with her own money and spending on bikes and all the rest. It's a case of, certainly, we try to make the money go as far as we can for getting away for a holiday or doing the things that we want to do together and all the rest. But at the same time, there's all every discussion of, well, should we get away for a quick weekend to wherever? And but that's poor. But the flights and the hotel, that's an hour set of tires at the time. So that math is like, there isn't a time of the year that math isn't done in terms of like calculating out what we're going to get out of that in comparison to how it will affect our seasons one way or the other.
But you've got a lifetime afterwards to go on your holidays. That's holiday when you're 60 and you've kind of done what you're...
Yeah,
you're not going to be young, this young forever, are you? So
yeah, we'll holiday and go to races when we're older.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah, without the pressure of actually racing. Yeah. So away from the bikes, obviously you've just said that the household is 100% bikes all the time, but you do have a day job. You work for a living. You're not lucky enough to be a factory rider, although the amount of times you're going away this winter, it does sound like you're a factory rider. You've just reeled off how many, before we started, three tests you've got.
Yeah.
So there's going to be no excuse this year.
No, absolutely not. You're really forgetting all the really important tests, things like Croft at the start of the season in early April, where, again, those tropical conditions will come into play.
100%.
We've been very fortunate in that way that this season, it looks like last year was the first time I ever tested in Spain. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go back to Spain because it seemed to work. We had a pretty good year last year. There's always a question of, you know, professional versus amateur at the TT and the level of the event. You know, it's a world-class level. I always used it as, I used a car share many moons ago when I was in much different work line of work with a guy who couldn't get it. And he was a golfer for whatever reason. I don't really get, if you want to hit a ball, get a dog to bring it back to you, whatever. Why you chase it yourself? I have no idea. But I said, he couldn't get it. And I said, but for 2 weeks of the year, I get to live a professional life. I get to go to the equivalent of Augusta or St. Andrews, and I get to play against Rory McIlroy or Tiger Woods or whoever your heroes are. Because Hickman, Dunlop, Harrison, McGuinness, whoever is there, they're with the best equipment. And whether you have that or don't have that is irrelevant. The fact that you get to turn up on a level playing field and be able to, I said, could you, if you won the lottery tomorrow, could you make that happen? Could you go to Augusta, get the top 20 golf players in the world and be there and make them and play a tournament against them on even footing? And he was like, all the money in the world wouldn't get you that. And I said, well, I have the opportunity to do that for 2 weeks. But come the Monday morning after, when the TT blues, when you get back and there's 300 emails unanswered, and you think, well, this time Saturday I was doing 192 down Sulby, and I was crossing the line and we were heading to the beer tent and all the rest. And it has to be said, the motivation on the Monday morning after the TT is never quite there, quite the same, you know. I probably shouldn't say that in case my boss is listening, but at the same time, it's really tough after that.
I think it's excusable, though, after going from such a high of 2 weeks, of being essentially a rock star, you know, and then having to go back to the day job. But what is the day job? What are you doing on a daily basis?
So, I mean, I've been very fortunate, as I say. Before I started racing, I was graduated as an engineer in motorcycle design and technology, and it was a case of I knew bikes is my life, and I wanted to work in the industry, and by hook or by crook I was going to get there one way or the other. And very fortunate that my day job now, I work for Royal Enfield now in the UK. Previously, I had a short spell at Norton, the new Norton, as it is, now in Solihull. And before that, I was with KTM out in Austria. So this is maybe one of the things that does give you a wee bit of wiggle room in terms of what you do. And also that Monday morning, a lot of the guys in the office are more interested. Good TT, brilliant 2 weeks. Oh, I was so chuffed to see 130, this, that, and the other, inside the top 10, blah, 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 and all this. So you get a lot of that on the Monday morning. But at the same time, I get to go in and talk about bikes all day.
Yeah.
And then I come home to my wife and talk about bikes. And then I go to the TT and talk about bikes. So, yeah.
You've got
to
love it.
Yeah. You see, we, on our crib sheet, it said, obviously, you lived in Austria, which you previously had.
Yeah.
So how did the Austrians deal with that Northern Irish twang?
Well,
are you fluent Austrian?
Definitely not.
It's German. They speak German.
Yeah, they speak German.
Yeah.
And
wasted on this, me.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry. Is this for the international podcast? I picked up enough to get by and live on, but I'm very thankful. I think we all are. We're a bit spoiled in that way. That the international language of business is English.
Yeah.
You go to Austria and the Austrians want to talk to Italians for brakes or suspension, it's done in English. You go to China for components, it's done in English. You go to Japan for other components, it's done in English. So you're very lucky that way. One thing that did come up after a number of years away was my international English accent.
Yeah,
because there was a lot more the overpronunciation and slowing down the rhythm of my of the way I spoke. I don't know why, because the Austrians in themselves, particularly different regions of it, they're German to Hochdeutsch to like High German or and all the rest is a bit what Northern Irish dialect is to the English language. Yeah, yeah. So in terms of it, they sort of get it because they don't speak really like High German. But yeah, it did run into a few interesting translation scenarios.
Yeah, I bet.
So at KTM, what for people listening, for people that own KTMs, what job or role did you have over those bikes? So what part of Sean Anderson was on those bikes when they were rolling off the production line?
So at KTM, I was a project leader, so in the R&D. So if you ride a Duke 390 or an RC 390, not that we're plugging because I work for a different manufacturer mm-hmm. now, so buy a Royal Enfield. And my job was the overall responsibility of technically delivering that bike. So whether it was engine calibration, chassis setup, handling, this and other manufacturing of parts, industrialization of the design from the industrial designer side. I had a team of engineers and technicians underneath me to deliver that. And so in that way, like I had the buck stopped with me in terms of if it was late or had problems or this, that and the other, it was for me to crack the whip and push the guys, whether it was the suspension guys, the chassis guys, the parts panel, the bodywork guys and all that stuff. Now for Enfield, I work as a concept engineer, so we work very early doors with new technologies. And most of the stuff that I actually do at Enfield, you will never see what I've done, only if we prove it out in terms of like feasibility, practicality and advantage. Then that will roll into their production engineering side of things. So it's only really very early advanced vehicle stuff that I work on at Enfield.
If you're trying to think outside the box there and just bring new stuff to the table.
I mean, like in terms of it, we're, you know, there's a big transition going on in the world with regards to EV mm-hmm. and like flexi fuels and these sorts of things. And I mean, we see it at the same time, like with the TT organizers in terms of like, if you stand still, you die. The amount of changes that they go through, they were very early adopters for EV. They were probably too early in terms of like commercial viability and all the rest. But in terms of that, you're always trying to push something into what will be the next big thing, or there's an interest, and hopefully that will relay eventually into a production model that will be successful, obviously, for the business in itself.
I just picked up on something there. You obviously mentioned the RC 390 when you was at KTM and being obviously the man, not just behind that, but you had to speak for anything, any of the problems and so on. Well, actually, I ran the RC 390 Cup and British Championship, the one make series. So you're telling me all the problems I had was your fault.
And that was the Gen 1 bike. So.
Oh, here we go. You're digging deep in the filing cabinet here for the excuses.
I was well prepared, but no. I mean, like...
good corporate answer.
Yeah. So that was through KTM UK, but I think the time frame that you were working on, it was just before I had started to fix a lot of those issues. Not that there was any issues.
So that's interesting enough, because I have this conversation an awful lot. I do a lot of test riding, as you know. Everywhere I test, all the proving grounds and private places, the majority of vehicles, nearly all vehicles I'm testing alongside, I'm on a normally aspirated machine. Everything is electric powered. So can you tell us anything? Because everybody's, all us petrol heads are denying we're going to have electric bikes taking over and racing.
Well, I mean, I think racing will be always is very niche, you know, in terms of like the numbers worldwide and all the rest. So I think there'll be a long line. I mean, this is purely speculative on my side. I'm looking into a glass ball like everybody else and hoping to see something. But I also think, you know, you've seen recently, without getting into like automotive industrial podcasting here and all
this. Let's go down that road. Come on, let's do it. I know loads.
You've seen a pushback from Toyota in terms of like EV and the there's an endless amount of propaganda on any of the socials with regards to, you know, child labour, digging cobalt out of mines in Africa and this, that and the other. I think there will always be a space in terms of, like, looking into the synthetic fuels. You see it at MotoGP now. I could imagine that we would eventually maybe see that trickle down into other formulas of racing.
Oh, there's already talk with BSP.
Exactly. Yep. So, and I could imagine at the same time, it wouldn't be outside the realms of the TT to do the same. You know, we're all environmentally, as much as we're there burning fuel and tires and all the rest, we're trying to do it in an environmentally sound way to do it. So that way, and the big thing is, like, I'm very, very fortunate. Like, with my job, I get to travel and experience some of the other cultures around the world of motorcycling cultures, because we think motorcycling primarily as a Western, like, we're here talking about TT and all this, mm-hmm. but the big numbers are Asia and South America mm-hmm. and all the rest, and they have a much bigger motorcycle culture. Maybe it's not a sporting culture. It's certainly developing into that and in certain aspects and all the rest. And, you know, earlier last year, I was out in Colombia in South America, and I don't really see them building a supercharger, you know, out in the hills of the Peru, mm-hmm. of in Peru or in Colombia and all the rest. Those sorts of markets will make sure that we're burning fossil fuels for quite a long time, and it'll be interesting to see how that develops one way or the other. But I think the internal combustion engine's here for quite a bit longer.
So just to finish that off, you've obviously, from a personal side, you've raced TT0.
Yes, yes.
Positive or negative? Do you enjoy it or not?
I very much did. I mean, I was involved with one of the universities. The university that I graduated from, Kingston, had a bike, so I was involved with that. And then one of my alumni that also graduated from that after, he wanted to run in the TT0. He was with Jaguar Land Rover in their EV series and was interested in bikes and all the rest. So, I mean, it was definitely, they talk about in racing, like, when 125s and 250s were a class of have and have nots. But I think, you know, the TT0 was definitely a class of have and have nots out there. And it was great to see other universities like Nottingham really step up the game and chase. But when you're in the time of the Moto Scissors and the Mugens, and I have to say, people, like, they're very hard on the TT0. The Mugens were probably the most technologically advanced bikes I've ever seen and will ever see around the Isle of Man, because we, you know, we're primarily racing production bikes. And in that, as an exercise, especially from somebody who's in the industry from a technical standpoint, they were amazing pieces of kit. Where you stand with wins and one lap races and all the rest, that you can get weighed down too much in like the politics of who's what records and all the rest. But I personally think we're missing something like that, and it, because maybe the event was burnt hard because we had so many pushback from a fan base that only wants to hear internal combustion engines run and all the rest. It might be to our detriment that we've gone from being an early adapter to being maybe late to the show because, you know, once burnt, twice shy sort of situation. But the industry isn't quite ready. It's just not there still. But when it comes, I'm sure it will come fast.
But we have got a series in MotoGP and Moto E, haven't we, that looks like it's promising and pushing forward year on year, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting. I mean... the fact that it's not an open category like the way TT0 was always is a bit of a leveler from a riding point of view. Could you imagine something like that around the TT to have all the riders on the same bike with the same this, that, and the other?
Well, I've said it before on normal machines, say normally combusted or electric, but it'd be incredible.
Yeah, and to have something so different like that would be an absolutely different approach to anything we've ever seen, and. You know, it's not beyond the realms, but I'm sure there's all sorts of contracts and commercial topics and all the rest that would be hard to overcome, but it'll maybe come in time.
Before we finish with your TT 2024, completely off the topic, we've just had the MotoGP test. Was it Sepang, I think? I've not really asked anybody this, but how do we think Marc Marquez is going to go on that Ducati? It's completely left field, but I'm interested to find out what
he'll be all right, won't he?
Do you think he'll be able to win championship though?
You would not. You wouldn't. This is my opinion, of course. You wouldn't bet against him. You know, he might. He may not struggle, but not quite be there at the beginning because you know, obviously, a lot of the riders have ridden with the same bike, same setup, and so on. He's on the best package. Without doubt, he'll be competitive. He really will. Yeah, but to win the championship is a tough ask. It really is.
The hardest thing I think that he will have to be. Is not Marc Márquez, because I think the last 2-3 years he's had to override every minute, every corner, every lap, and has cost himself that, and now trying to step back to be like, the package will actually carry you towards the front, and you just need to be a tiny bit of what you were. It should be enough, but I feel like when you've had maybe not the best machinery and had problems to overcome, getting out of that mindset of constantly overriding and then overriding and making mistakes, that might be his downfall. But at the same time, I mean, when he came as a rookie and won in his first year, he was able to make some mistakes. But the level of consistency that's now required at the front is so tough that space to try and relearn a different machine and learn something so different than having to override for that long. That might catch him out, I think.
So, as an engineer as well, what's our opinion on what we're seeing in MotoGP? Wings, spoilers, just, has it gone too far?
I don't really think you can go too far. I mean, the problem is, where we're talking about is it engineering, is it racing, or is it entertainment?
Yeah.
Because certainly from an entertainment point of view, people worrying about the front tire being 0.1 bar too high and how you can't sit in a slipstream and all the rest. It hasn't been the most entertaining series in the last year or two. Mm-hmm. From an engineering point of view, you can absolutely, like, it's engineering porn in terms of that. So, I mean, we see it starting to, like, slowly seep into the TT, like the bikes, the level of the bikes at the very front are on a different, like, are right up there, like, the wings on the BMW, and Honda's also now coming with a different aero package for the new Fireblade and all the rest. Whether we'll ever get to the idea of lowering devices and all the rest, the TT in itself, in so many ways, pushes the boundaries of technology, but it's also an old school track that old school solutions solve a lot of the time. Yeah. So it's a complete, like, contradiction in terms of itself, of what would be, what could be, and what it allows, because, you know, it's that old sort of adage of, wouldn't it be great to see what a Formula One car or whatever could do? Well, it'd be teetering like a seesaw over Balaf. And it's like, you know, it's just one of those sorts of things. It's like a Formula One car from 60, 80 years ago would be better suited because it has real suspension and this, that, and the other, and all these sorts of things. I actually had a really interesting discussion with the Birchalls over, like, a sidecar is, you know, it's a race car minus one wheel. Mm-hmm. And in terms of, like, aero and what could be done there and all that, but at the same time, it's road race and like leaning in to having not mechanical grip, to having aero grip, and the ripples and bumps that could potentially upset the airflow around it. And all of a sudden, all that downforce and grip that you had might not be there.
Yeah.
It's the sort of thing that you could never, until the place is, like, you know, absolutely, like, football pitch smooth, like, you couldn't lean in and trust it. So it's such a compromise of where you could find advantages and really develop the machinery around that end. But at the same time, it's such a challenge, like, from an engineering point of view, to make it work and also have the trust and be able to lean into that technology, because consequences are pretty high.
Yeah. I understand that side of it, but you know, obviously you talked about the lowering devices now, MotoGP and so on. We've seen the new GS1300 road bike with the same thing coming up traffic lights, it can lower down for short leg riders and so on, but aero, you can do 60 mile an hour maximum on UK roads, and that's quite fast compared to Europe, and 70 on the motorway. I don't think you really need aero for that.
No, but it sells bikes. People are like, oh, big shiny parts that are made out of carbon and all the rest. That bling's hard to go past when you're walking past the showroom. So,
yeah, you're right. So let's look forward to TT 2024. We've broke the 130 mark, which we're very proud of.
Absolutely.
It's no mean feat. What's the target? What are the goals? What's the plan for you?
Well,
in 24,
we're etching at the bit at the moment in terms of start numbers, because start numbers mean everything until you actually get there and then realize they mean nothing. It's where you finish, not where you start. So that's an exciting time at the moment. Plans are slowly coming together. We definitely be in the seated riders again. I mean, we all, but this internal joke in the house that I'm probably one of the faster riders, but like I'd definitely be the seated rider. But if you asked the man on the street or the guy in the paddock of the TT, name all 20 seated riders, they would probably get to that sort of like 18 of them and then be like, that guy with the beard, the big guy.
The doorman.
Yeah. The Belfast doorman.
The club last week.
He's like the fastest rider that no one's ever heard of. And so it's one of those sorts of things. I mean, we'd not try and turn this into a cycling podcast, but I know there's definitely a soft spot from one of you about that.
Steve loved it.
Yeah, exactly. we've seen the pictures in the spandex in the light room.
He made me.
So it was consensual.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, so what about what?
Hold on, no, let's go back to this cycling.
Sorry.
There's a great, in your box. My wife read a book and she
told you about cycling. It's for them lazy kids that don't want to run.
She read a book called Atomic Habits, and it talks about like Team GB cycling coach and bringing in people to be like these marginal gains and trying to think and not have a goal mentality, because a goal leaves you empty once you've fulfilled it. Like you see, even like endless Olympic winners like Michael Phelps like had like issues after his Olympic career was over, because you've reached your goal and you're 35 or whatever, and now what do? You have an emptiness. Yeah. So it's always like, I think, and I've tried to bring that in terms of like, well, it's constant improvement. So, I mean, without doubt, we were 17:21. So 17:10, without being a goal, is a reason to try and improve too, and find reasons to get that improvement, how you find those marginal gains to close that next gap. Because we would say, in terms of the TT, we have the three aliens. At the top, and when you look at their times, they're really the only three that have done sub 17 round there. The next ones you have like Connor and Hutchie 17:0 on the button, which is heartbreaking, but you have that like from fourth till seventh gap that are in the 1:32 mark, and that's got to be like the next part to try a piece of the puzzle to try and like get there and be involved in that part of the race. And you know, you have your Johns, your Jamie Cowards, your Helliers and all the rest. And that's within striking distance. It's a 10-11 second gap from where I am at the minute. And that's less of a gap than where we were from my PB previously to PB in 2023.
Yeah.
So that, everything that I do, every early morning session in the gym or time on the bicycle or rowing, whatever, is in an aid or talk to the mechanics, the team managers, the crew guys. Oh, I want to have this. I want to have my knee slightly. It comes down to like talking to the leather manufacturers. Last year, I saw pictures of like a flap of leather up above the my shoulder, like when I was trying to get tucked in. I was like, can we get that it's out of the wind, because I'm already too big a seal trying to push through the wind as it is. Although we won't talk about leathers and zips and stuff. And it's the only time I'm really bumped into Steve is when my zip exploded in 2023 at Douglas Road Corner. And but all those sorts of like small marginal gains now at this stage, you know, when you look at it as 136 as percentages, like nominal percentages to try and gain, you are like 1-2% away in this sector, 1-2% there, whether that's rider, whether it's equipment, whether it's everything. So all those things you have to try and like drill down on. I mean, there's still like overall in that time, especially to the top three aliens, there's a massive gap, but trying to incrementally close those gaps to the next one. That's why I'm here, and I'm still coming back year after year.
still work to be done.
His wife was right, wasn't she? He is methodical.
Very.
A lot of thought process.
Boring, I think you mean.
No, honestly, I'm not. No.
If you could pick an ideal start number, where would you start?
I mean,
based on who else is around you as well.
I mean, it's interesting. I think we've seen like guys who were trying to make that jump, like Jamie got up at number 4, and we saw it with Hillier in the past, that a low number and a year of learning, because you're going to be caught and you're going to see things, because there'll be a number of guys, and I'm quite friendly with a number of guys who are outside of the seeded numbers, because we came up together and just different friendships formed. The closer you get to the front, the further the riders are away from you, because I never see Hickman or Dunlop or Dean, because they're usually away, even in practice, in the first 3 or 4 bikes, and I might be bike 7 or 8, even if we've pushed up, you know, got up early and all that. Yeah. So you'd be better starting at number 40 on the road, because Peter will probably catch you on his flying lap, and you'll see a bit. You might not see a lot, because maybe your pace at number 50, it's not quite comparable, but you'll see maybe something different. Whereas the closer you get to the front, especially the number of years that I was sort of like in the early 20s, so just outside of that seeded run, you're outside of that block, you don't see the front guys, and you don't really see the back guys. You're in your own bubble, so your improvement has to come from yourself. So yeah, it's interesting to see. I mean, the numbers that always sort of like pop up in your head is like, Peter's an interesting one at 10, because everybody thinks, well, he's got a lot of traffic to deal with, but maybe he likes the chase that we talked about earlier. You know, the earlier number, I think for certain guys that are trying to make that jump into the next stage, because you're going to be caught, you're going to see stuff that are there.
So
a lower number would be better. I mean, the overthinking of my thought into this goes way, way beyond what we could capture today in terms of, well, you're also like, the low numbers, we sort of see, like, you get more exposure, you're on the TV, that means sponsorship, that means opportunities, those sorts of things all roll into each other. So I think in general, lower is better. And once you then have got to the pinnacle, I don't know, Steve, as somebody who's been at the very, very front, you can maybe say what it's like to actually have a preference to choose. But in terms of like, both as a competitor to see what your other competitors are doing, lower is better, whether you're caught, getting away, that level of exposure, that all those sorts of things in terms of that all would help. So yeah, I don't have a favorite number inside that top 20, but lower is always better.
Did you have a preference?
No, not really. I think, you know, the only thing I was worried about was being held up, you know, because you know as well as anyone, obviously, that how hard it is to pass, even when you're on the same pace, how hard it is to pass safely.
Yeah.
Especially on the faster set, it's all fast around a TT course, but the faster set over the mountain, you know, it's so hard to get by, and it can cost you an awful lot of time when we're seeing times now so close to get on the podium and so on. So that was the only thing I was worried about in my short TT racing career as such. But anyway, going back to what we said, obviously, Chris moved on to 2024. What is the situation? Who are you riding for? Is it your own thing? Is it a team? Who are you with?
As it stands at the minute, we like the Team Classic Suzuki, so Steve Wheatman and Nathan, they were really happy with what we did last year. I mean, I think the Suzuki's quite a well-proven bike, shall we say, at this stage, to be kind. And that, I think there's still more potential. You know, I make no bones about it. I'm very anorak about the whole situation, so compared against the ideal, so the fastest ever Suzuki lap is Michael at 133.7. Where can I make time? Where is the difference between me as a rider and Michael as a rider? But given the same level of machinery on those two things, why is that time being lost and all the rest? Hopefully we're going to have a Honda Superstalker. So it definitely seems to be the way forward. It's turning into a wee bit of a Honda Cup at the moment. I think you have the Honda and the BM is really the two strongest packages out there. So I was given an opportunity to sort of see what that's going to be like. I haven't ridden the bike yet, so
it's the new one.
It's the previous model.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's not the new one for 24. So in that way, I'm interested. I mean, I've been a bit of a one-trick pony in terms of Suzuki through most of my career. So it's also, I guess, a tentative dipping of the toe because the Suzuki's there. We have the data. We've ridden it for since it basically came out in 17 that if we have a bad practice week, good old faithful's there, and there's still a bit to go in it from my side and from in terms of the outright speed of what I can get out of that. But, you know, one thing about the TT is it never standing still. The machinery, you know, if you can have a 22 bike or a 23 bike or a 24 bike, you'll always pick the newest there.
Yep.
And it's a case of, well, we'll see if we gel with the new bike or with a different manufacturer. And in doing that, it'll also be a step forward because that bike came 3 or 4 years after the Suzuki. So all those things have moved on, the electronics, the way the chassis is, all those sorts of things. So trying to cover off all bases in terms of that.
Sorry, mate, will you ride that in the Superbike then, or will you ride the Suzuki Superbike and then Honda potentially stock?
The plan is that the Suzuki Superbike is set up with, like, all things quick change wheel and all the rest, and the Honda is purely a stocker.
Right.
I have no idea in terms of how it'll work out at the end of practice week. There could be a difficult conversation to be had there, but I think, like, there's still enough. I mean, the TT is such a gamble. You know, we could be sitting there with a bad practice week for whatever reason, mechanical issues and all this, and having that sort of like well-known card in your back pocket.
Just to pull out.
Just to be there, to be like, well, we have the satins from last year. We know it works. How's the satin the other? I don't know if it goes the other way, how it will work. I mean, at the end of the day, it's still business, and I've made an agreement to ride the Suzuki in the 2 6 lap races.
Yeah.
So I even hate thinking about it at the minute, but we'll cross that bridge when we get there.
Oh yeah, rather you than me.
Hopefully you won't need to.
No. Steve, before you take the last sip of your water, too late. Steve's quick fire questions are coming up right now. I feel like we need a jingle for Steve's quick fire questions now. I think we're at that time. Steve's quick fire questions.
Right, quick fire questions. You've listened to all the podcasts. You know what it is. You just answer one or the other. No excuses. No nothing. Beer or wine?
Beer.
Modern or classic bikes?
Modern.
Pineapple or never pineapple on a
pizza?
Get out. Flip it now. I'll tell you what. Time trial or mass start?
Time trial.
Orange or blue?
Orange.
Ooh. Cameron Donald or Michael Dunlop?
Cam Donald.
Ginger Hall to Ramsey or Ramsey to Bungalow?
Ginger Hall to Ramsey.
Northern Ireland or the Isle of Man?
The Isle of Man.
Washing or drying?
Washing.
Pay for a factory TT ride or pay for the wife to go racing? In your own time.
I think we're out of time, are we?
No, we've just got enough time for this.
Factory.
Factory, good lad. That's the answer I wanted.
Sean, it's been an absolute pleasure. I feel like we could have probably sat here and chatted another 2 or 3 hours about engineering and motorcycles. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, mate, and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, good luck in 2024.
Cheers.
Steve, Sean Anderson has left the building. He's sat right there, so this is going to be hard to have an outro conversation about him. But
it's a cracker. He's on door duty tonight. He had to shoot off quick. Sorry, guys. It should have been longer.
Hey, what a fascinating chat, though. Do you know what? And he is still in the building, but I will say this. Like, I started going to the TT in 2022 and saw Sean going up and down, and that's all I ever saw of him, like, kind of going up and down the paddock. And you get a false impression of what someone's like because you only see them going up to war, in effect. So you see this real stern, intense character. But then you actually sit down and chat with him and he's completely different.
Yeah, 100%. I'm great to hear he's been doing some training and getting his head buried and getting fit this year, because I was at Douglas Road Corner last year and he burst out of his leathers, bust the zip. So it's looking good. He's going to be a fit man this year.
Was that a mechanical or was that a rider error? Oh,
I think it's too many nights on the door, I think.
But in all honesty, he's looking in good shape. He's going to be looking in even in better shape come TT 2024. He's got a real shot of a good result, a good solid top 10.
Yeah, without doubt. You know, we've listened to how methodical he is. He thinks everything through massively, mm-hmm. and he's not trying to get too far in front of himself, just trying to step forward and keep improving.
Yeah, yeah, I'm excited to see what he does. He is still here, so he is looking at us. But give us a prediction. What do you think? Senior TT race.
Oh, that's a good question. Well, 130.357 last year, I believe.
357?
Yeah, anyway, somewhere near there.
We may as well call it 131.
He'll just want to be getting faster, obviously, and just jump into that next step and targeting the people in front of him.
So that's it for this episode of the TT Podcast. Now, wherever you've been listening to your podcast, please leave us a rating and a review. It makes a massive difference and Steve really does appreciate it. Now, next week will be something completely different because I'll be coming to you from the Road to 2024 event, the official launch for the 2024 Isle of Man TT races. Ooh! Stay tuned to your podcast apps and find out how I get on from the Isle of Man next week. As always, head over to IOMTT Races for all the latest news and features. And next time I speak to you, I'll be on the island. See you later, Steve.
Ta-da.